all your pretty guys with thunderous applause.
You are listening to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host, Scott, with Uncle Ian. And today we have for you a matchup between the Mongolian dictator Genghis Khan and the Chinese dictator Deng Xiaoping. Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause is a history podcast obsessed with history's dictators. We have created a knockout competition to determine the single most significant dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup between two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. So let's start with Genghis Khan, shall we? Now, Genghis Khan was the leader of Mongolia from 1200 to 1227. He was actually named Temujin. He was named after a man that his father had killed in battle. I'm going to continue calling him Genghis for your convenience and mine. The Mongols at this time were a nomadic herding tribe on the steppe, which is a area of grassland in Central Asia. So they were raiders that usually raided other Mongol tribes and other nomadic peoples on the steppe. And Genghis Khan would go on to build the world's largest continuous empire. Genghis Khan was born in 1162. He was the son of a powerful chieftain, but his father was poisoned by the Tatars. And so he was raised by his mum, and he was very poor as a child. They often went starving, and he actually killed his brother over a dispute over food. Genghis gets a wife, who is then kidnapped in a raid. During the raid in which she's kidnapped, Genghis and the other men escape on horseback, but there's not enough horses for his wife, so they just leave her there to be kidnapped. It demonstrates some of the ruthlessness and cold-bloodedness that he would show later on in life. He persuaded Jamukha, a local Mongol leader, to raise an army to help rescue his wife. And they eventually did get her back. And when she returned, she actually came back pregnant. This would cause problems later on because Genghis would claim that the son was his, but there was always doubts over who the father of the child was. Genghis only leads a small troop of people, but he changes everything about warfare on the steppe. When he defeats a neighboring tribe, he absorbs the remaining victims into his tribe. This changes the cyclical nature of warfare on the steppe, where usually you raid, you steal, and you leave, and then later that same tribe would do the same to you. Whereas by absorbing Mongols into his tribe, he was able to completely destroy the other tribe and grow his tribe. So he does this to the Gurkhid and then later to the Tatars. He makes the Tatars famous because most people know that he beheaded any Tatar that was taller than his wheel on his cart, which was only 90 centimeters tall. So he beheaded a lot of people. In 1204, the other Mongol leaders came to realize that Genghis Khan was becoming quite powerful, and Jamukha, his former friend, would actually challenge him. Genghis was so respected that Jamukha's own men betrayed him and handed Jamukha over to Genghis Khan. And in 1206, there was a Kurul Thai voting system by which the Mongols will decide a new grand leader. And this Kurul Thai, they chose Genghis Khan to lead them. Genghis Khan is declared the Great Khan and the ruler of all Mongols. And so this is what made Genghis Khan exceptional. The Mongols were exceptional warriors, but Genghis was not exceptional in this regard amongst Mongols. Genghis was exceptional for his leadership. He unites all these battling, warring Mongol tribes under one banner. And he does this because he's charismatic and he's persuasive, as we saw in his ability to persuade Jamukha to raise an army to help rescue his wife. And as leader, he would enact policies that would ensure stability amongst the Mongols. So he bans the theft of wives, which was ubiquitous and would lead to war. And he also bans theft and slavery. And this would stop raiding amongst different tribes and create unity, which is what he needed. The other very clever thing that he does is he scatters the absorbed tribes amongst his army rather than allowing one tribe to exist as a single unit. They end up becoming loyal to him rather than loyal to their tribal group. The other very clever thing that Genghis would do in terms of his leadership, he was always on the lookout for talent. He promoted his generals based on their ability and based on their loyalty to him rather than based on their nobility. He even recruited from enemy soldiers. He once very famously during a battle had his horse shot, and at the end of the battle, which they won, he said to the opposition, "Who shot my horse?" And a man reluctantly put his hand up and he said, "Okay, now you work for me." He respected good talent and he wanted to poach good talent. And he did that again and again. He took gunpowder technicians from China and engineers from the Muslim empires that he conquered. And this would allow him to change his warfare tactics as needed by consistently growing and taking the best from each empire that he destroyed. Genghis, with his Mongol army united behind him, takes over northern China. And then, after his emissary is killed, and then his second emissary is killed by the Khwarizm Shah Emperor, he invades the Khwarizm Shah Empire, which is currently Iran, Central Asia, bit of Turkey, and absolutely destroys them and takes that entire empire. From there, they go into Russia and Ukraine, and for now, that's where they stop. They have to go back to China to deal with the Jinjar, who he had already conquered, but refused to send him men for the campaign in the Middle East. And so this is considered a revolt. So Genghis Khan actually goes back to China to deal with that. In terms of their tactics, they were absolutely deadly. They were all cavalry. They had no infantry. So they're all on horseback and they shot very, very powerful arrows. And their bows were better than anything that they had in Eastern Europe. They also carried a short sword and a lance with a hook on it. Genghis was very diligent in doing his homework. He would scout battlefield terrain for a week before the fighting. And kids these days, they want to start an empire without doing their homework, but Genghis teaches us, you have to do your homework, kids, if you want to get anywhere in life. He also loved what's called the exemplary massacre, where he would kill everybody in a town if they didn't surrender to him. One such massacre, he killed 1.7 million people in the city of Nishapur, plus all the cats and dogs. The exemplary massacre would be an example to other people, and often cities would just surrender to them and he would leave them relatively unharmed and just take all their wealth. Genghis and the Mongols also liked what's called the fake retreat, where they would start a skirmish, retreat, then they would be chased by the enemy, which would break their line. And then the Mongols would turn around and absolutely obliterate the enemy. And they would do this again and again, and people would keep falling for it. But when they would encounter walled cities, they had to switch up their tactics. And they would eventually use catapults and gunpowder. They would throw flaming pots over the walled cities. And sometimes they would even throw diseased carcasses over a walled city. In terms of empire building, Genghis Khan is probably second to none. He killed 35 million people and took more land in 25 years than the Romans did in 400.
In terms of warfare tactics, the key element was just the sheer growth of the empire in such a short space of time. Basically, from the start of the 13th century, the Mongol Empire was only very small, and by the end of the 13th century, they'd reached Europe, they'd reached modern-day Vietnam, modern-day Afghanistan. It's amazing the relative speed with which the Mongol Empire spread.
That quick spread facilitated the Eurasian trade that the Mongol Empire has become famous for by dominating such a large area that connected the Middle East to Asia and to Europe. It brought about an immense amount of trade. And because the Mongols didn't really produce anything, they really just taxed the sedentary populations that they conquered. They needed a way to make money. And so trade was a great way for them to do that. As a result, there was all this mixing between these previously disconnected cultures. And that brings us tea. It's not yet 9:15, so you don't have a cup of tea. But the reason you're about to have a cup of tea is because of the Mongols. They also brought to Europe silk, which became very popular, gunpowder, which became quite unpopular, and Arabic mathematics, which was very useful because the Europeans didn't have absolutely everything correct. And they even brought, say, water-powered milling because grain had to be milled by hand, and that technology was very useful. It also brought pants. Uncle Ian, again, you're probably wearing pants, or I hope you're wearing pants. That is because of the Mongols. Europeans started wearing pants and not togas. So in terms of their significance, the Mongols achieved quite a lot. The Mongols were also very famous for their religious tolerance. They were shamanists and they believed in the sky god. Their religion was connected to the land. They allowed all religions under their empire to carry on as normal. And this actually wasn't really out of the goodness of their heart. It was really a tool to subjugate as many people as possible because by not disturbing their religious practices, it allowed the local population to accept the Mongol rule. They were the first population to have widespread paper money, which again facilitated all this trade that we've been talking about. They managed to achieve relatively greater safety, again, which helped facilitate trade. It was said that a virgin could walk from one side of the empire to another with a basket of gold on her head without being robbed. I mean, apart from the 35 million people that he killed, it did create safety and security that would allow this trade.
Have we mentioned the Silk Road itself? It's known even today as a path between East and West, and that was created under the Mongol Empire. The linking of Northeast Asia and Muslim Southwest Asia and right through into Christian Europe as an example of the growth of the empire and the trade and communication that followed was a huge achievement for the Mongol Empire, especially given its small beginnings.
The consequences of the empire was not all positive. The increased trade also brought the bubonic plague, the Black Death, to Europe. However, luckily, greater trade with Asia would never again unleash a deadly disease on the world. If you don't get that joke, either A, it's not funny, or B, we're recording this separately because of the coronavirus. It's 2020. Other bad things the Mongols did, and there's a lot, strap yourself in. They destroyed whole cities. Whole cities were destroyed. Historians believe that the Middle East is just recovering from what Genghis Khan did to it. They destroyed libraries and irrigation systems. Whole sources of wealth and knowledge were lost because of what the Mongols did to those cities. Also, 1 in 200 people are descended from Genghis Khan. Now, that's impressive, but a lot of these births resulted from conquered lands, and so you can draw your own conclusions there. I know it's a different time and everything, and the Me Too movement hadn't really got started yet, but still, we probably should mention his treatment of captives. Captives were used as human shields, and sometimes as moat fillers, which is as bad as it sounds. And in terms of an empire, they were all slaughter and didn't really produce any architecture or art or culture. They really just facilitated cultural transmission. They didn't really produce anything themselves. Here's this quote I have from Genghis Khan, which summarizes who he is quite well. He says, "The greatest happiness is to vanquish your enemies, to rob them of their wealth, and to see those dear to them bathed in tears." If we're going to give the Mongols and Genghis Khan credit for creating this transcontinental pathway in the Silk Road and creating all that trade and cultural communication, then they have to be credited for everything that happens as a result of their empire. For example, the Europeans were so scared of the Mongols, they went into some sort of anti-Semitic hysteria and ended up massacring Jews in Europe who they somehow blamed for the Mongol invasion. If we can give the Mongols credit for the Silk Road, do they get credit for the massacring of the Jews? It's hard to know how we can assign blame and credit. One last thing I'd like to add about some of the terrible things the Mongols did. After the defeat of the Kievan Rus, which was the Ukrainian-Russian alliance, the Mongols defeated the Kievan Rus and gathered up all the nobles, and the Mongols had a feast, and they created a platform which they put on top of the Russian nobles and sat and ate their feast on top of this platform. And as they ate, they slowly crushed and suffocated the Russian nobles. I just think that's incredible.
That's appalling. Creative.
Very creative. That's just the ruthlessness of them just like eating away at a chicken sandwich while these Russian nobles are getting suffocated underneath them. I just find it incredible.
Sandwich wasn't invented till the 18th century, but that's a different conversation.
No, you're right. No, I can't imagine a Mongol eating a sandwich. They missed out on me too. They missed out on the sandwich.
Too busy killing people.
Too busy killing people. 35 million. It's a lot of people. Genghis Khan dies in 1227 in that battle against the Jinjiar that I mentioned earlier, where he rode back to China. The best explanation is that he fell off a horse and then slowly died after that. He's succeeded by his son Ogedai. So his sons and grandsons grew the empire. They took over the rest of China, Tibet, what is now Korea, all across Central Asia in all the stands, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. They took over Iran and most of modern Turkey, and they went as far as Israel in the south. In the north, they went up as far as Moscow, and in the west, they took all of Hungary, stopping at Vienna in Austria. So it is a huge empire. They go from the Danube to the Pacific. The empire without Genghis then splits into four. So there's
an empire, a Chinese empire, Russian empire, a Central Asian and a Middle Eastern empire. And then infighting and local uprising would slowly wear away at the empires. The empire then disintegrated. So it only really lasted until Kublai Khan's death in 1294. The empire lasts really less than 100 years in its true form. It demonstrates it's very easy to conquer, but very hard to rule a large area. But also demonstrates how unique Genghis was to be able to unite the Mongols over such a large territory. Without him, his sons start fighting, the empire fractures, and then he's ultimately weakened.
It's interesting you drew a parallel between the amount of land that the Mongols conquered and compared that to the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire grew up over centuries and centuries, whereas the Mongol Empire expanded from the start of the 13th century right through to the 1290s. But like the Roman Empire, it became too big for itself, far too big for any of his successors to hold together, and so it wasn't able to survive as an empire without someone as ruthless and as strong as Genghis Khan. Yeah, he's not without his chances in this competition. 35 million is a big number.
And in terms of population.
Well, that's true, in terms of per capita.
And he's got that thing about sitting on the Russians.
You're a fan of that, aren't you?
I am a fan. Okay, not only will we find the world's biggest dictator, by the end of the competition, we'll find the maddest dictatorial act. And right now, sitting on the Russians is the winner of the maddest dictatorial act.
While eating a chicken sandwich and a cup of tea.
He was eating a chicken sandwich, what did you say? 500 years before their invention.
And drinking a cup of tea. And wearing pants,
which we all should be grateful for. Moving on. In Mongolia, Genghis Khan is loved. He's considered the founder of the country. He's a symbol of national pride. So when Mongolia fell into the Soviet orbit and became communist, the communists didn't like that sort of nationalism and actually banned any mention of Genghis Khan. And then when the communists fell, Mongolia now has Genghis Khan on their currency. And there's a 40-meter statue of Genghis Khan outside the Mongolian capital. Up against Genghis Khan today, we have the Chinese ruler Deng Xiaoping. Uncle Ian, please tell us about Deng Xiaoping.
Thank you, Scott. Deng Xiaoping is known to history as China's paramount leader between 1978 and 1992. He was born in 1904 in Sichuan province, which is in the southwest of China. He was born into an educated landowning family. And during the 1920s, he studied in France, where he first learned about Marxist-Leninist theory. By 1923, he had joined the Communist Party of China. And on his way back to Shanghai, he studied for a while in Moscow itself before returning to China in 1927. At that stage, there were a number of different factions in China. China was nationalist by that stage. It was no longer a monarchy. And Deng Xiaoping, while a member of the Communist Party, he was pretty much a nationalist first. And he realized that the Communist Revolution was the best way for China to become prestigious in the world. The big event of the 1930s in the revolution was the Long March. That started in 1934. And that was the Communist Party escaping from the nationalists, the Chiang Kai-shek nationalists. And on that march throughout rural China, Mao and his followers were trying to determine what sort of a Communist Party they wanted. The outcome of that was that the Chinese Communist Party had a very rural base, which was actually disappointing to Stalin. Stalin did not want a Chinese Communist Party to have momentum of its own. He wanted it to be almost a satellite of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. During the 1930s, the communists and the nationalists in China were opposed up until 1937. That was the year in which the Japanese invaded, and there was an uneasy alliance between the communists and the nationalists through until 1945. After the war, Deng was a supporter of Mao right up until the proclamation of the People's Republic. That was in October of 1949. At that stage, the Nationalist Party still held part of the south of China, and Deng was sent to help the communists run the nationalists out of town, which he was able to do in the early 1950s. He was involved also in the takeover of Tibet, which historically hadn't been part of China.
Don't tell them that.
I think they know. If not, they'll find out by listening. In 1952, Deng returned to Beijing and gained office in the government as Minister of Finance. He was involved in trying to launch some reformist economic policies, and part of this was lessons learnt from the Soviet Union's brand of communism. The collective farms in the Soviet Union were a disincentive to the farmers because anything that they produced was taken by the state, whereas Deng, as long ago as the 1950s, realised that the farmers would work better if they had an incentive, and he wanted to give them that incentive. It led to a faction dispute within the Communist Party and was one of the reasons why Mao launched the Cultural Revolution, because Mao was very much a communist first and wanted to make sure that nothing stood in the way. Mao and Deng were often opposed throughout the 1960s. In fact, at one stage, Deng was sent back to a rural area to work in a tractor factory, back to his rural origins. By 1975, Deng had worked his way back into a position of authority in the party, was entrusted by Mao with looking after an area in Yunnan province, which had some discontent, and so Deng was involved in repressing that discontent. The records show there were some 1,600 deaths as part of Deng reaffirming the Communist Party's control over Yunnan province. Mao died in 1976. There were a number of candidates to succeed Mao as the leader of Communist China. Mao's chosen successor was Hu Guofeng. Over the next couple of years, there was a lot of behind-the-scenes politicking. Most sources use the term outmaneuvered. Deng was able to outmaneuver Huo and became the senior authoritarian figure. Interestingly, he didn't hold office as the general secretary of the party or as premier, and hence the title of paramount leader is the title by which Deng is most widely known. He was able to confirm himself in that office as of December of 1978.
As you say, despite not being favoured by Mao, he manages to become the leader of China shortly after Mao's death. We haven't covered Stalin, but it's a lot like how Stalin survives Lenin's criticisms of Stalin and then later dies, and Stalin still is able to consolidate power himself in Russia. It's interesting to see Deng Xiaoping do the same thing in communist China.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think there were some learnings there for him. So when Deng became paramount leader, he was the ripe old age of 74, which for a chain smoker was pretty good going. So Deng, as paramount leader, he repudiated the Cultural Revolution. He blamed it on a group called the Gang of Four, one of whom was Madame Mao, and they were actually put on trial and found guilty of treasonous activities. So interesting parallels there again, in that Khrushchev repudiated Stalinism after Stalin's death. Deng was able to repudiate Mao and his Cultural Revolution after he became leader of China. So some of the things that happened during Deng's time in office: he instigated a family planning policy, which became well known throughout the world. He realised that China was going to become overpopulated, so that was launched under Deng. He organised a compulsory education, a 9-year compulsory education in the schools. He also brought in constitutional reform, which included term limits for public officials. That was a big innovation that Deng brought in. He also very much opened up the Chinese economy to foreign trade. In fact, he had 4 modernisations that he worked on throughout his time as leader: agriculture, industry, science and technology, and the 4th one was the military. To Deng being leader, the military was not a meritocracy. He moved for it to become meritocracy so that it would be a much more effective army. Fortunately, he didn't need to put that to the test very often. Early in his reign, there was a war with Vietnam, but that was pretty much the extent of wars during his time. His time is remembered as being not so much an ideological time. he always believed there was room for market forces. In fact, he's quoted as saying that socialism and the market economy are not incompatible, which, if you'll excuse the double negative, is certainly not what Mao would have wanted him to say. Under Deng, there were local incentives for peasants to sell their produce, so he dismantled the collective farms. And in fact, the local provinces were allowed to make investments in industries that they thought would be profitable, especially if they had local natural resources. This led to a massive increase in the standard of living for the Chinese population. And the setting up of special economic zones allowed international trade to flourish across China.
He doesn't seem to be very much an ideologue. He's very much a pragmatist.
Yes.
And after learning of the failures of collectivism in the Soviet Union, he realized that economic growth was the key to prosperity in China and the key to his nationalistic ambitions to turn China into a world power. He realizes that the method is not as important as the outcome. Quoted as saying, probably his most famous quote is when he said, "We don't care if it's a black cat or a yellow cat. As long as it catches a rat, it's a good cat."
Yes, it was about outcomes. You're exactly right. So he was very internationally focused. So, for example, he met with President Carter in 1979, met with Margaret Thatcher in 1984, and that was part of that was the talks about the return of Hong Kong.
And he was very firm with the British about Hong Kong. Margaret Thatcher had just come off the victory in the Falklands and thought, maybe I'll keep Hong Kong for myself. And Deng Xiaoping said, no way.
Yes, exactly. He'd made up his mind. And he met with Mikhail Gorbachev in 1989 as well. So he certainly had an international focus. That was rewarded in 1979 when the United States gave diplomatic recognition to the regime in Beijing. Prior to that, for the previous 30 years, the US had not recognized the Beijing government. They'd still recognized the nationalist government in Taiwan.
The nationalist government in Taiwan claimed to be the true rulers of China.
Yes. And in fact, throughout the first three post-war decades, had held membership of the United Nations on that basis. But US recognition in 1979 was a massive turning point in opening up China to the world.
And that was just a more recognition of fact than anything else.
It was, yeah. Yeah, whether you liked communism or not, you had to recognize that that's what that government was. And the fact that they'd had a relatively peaceful transition after the death of Mao, I think made the US realize that the Communist Party was there to stay, even though they were rebranding communism. The major thing that struck me about Deng Xiaoping, as we look at all of the dictators on our list, is that he was in a position where he was able to retire. We don't get many dictators that retire, but that's exactly what happened in 1992. Deng had picked his successor. His successor was Jiang Zemin. And he was confident enough that Jiang, who certainly wasn't charismatic, they certainly weren't going to go back to the cult of personality that was in place under Mao. They were confident that Jiang would continue with his political and economic policies after Deng stepped down in 1992, although he was still a power behind the throne up until his death in 1997. One of the things that I most remember about the rule of Deng Xiaoping was in June of 1989, and some of our older listeners will remember the Tiananmen Square protests. The protests started as a reaction to the death and funeral of a previous senior member of the party, Hu Yaobang, and the protest was against some of the older leaders of the party. Even though there was increased prosperity in China, there was still no element of any sort of democracy or any sort of voice in government for the citizenry. And so the Tiananmen Square protests, which lasted for a month and a half, eventually the tanks rolled in. And there were graphic images of the tanks rolling into Tiananmen Square. The official toll was 3,000 killed, but I'm sure it was more than that. After the event, there was quite a significant blame game as to who was behind the orders. However, it's hard to believe that the government's reaction wouldn't have happened without Deng's say-so. So he's got to take some responsibility for that repression having happened.
The most significant thing for me about the Tiananmen Square protest and massacre that followed is the date. 1989 is the year that communist regimes are falling across the world, and China is still a communist regime because of the repression that happened in Tiananmen Square.
Yes, yeah, that's very true, that whatever you think of his methods, he certainly ensured that China was stable, and the comparison with other contemporary communist countries is important. And one of the things that Deng worked really hard to do was dismantle the cult of leadership which had been in place in China under Mao. Of course, he'd seen it in the Soviet Union under Stalin. He was seeing it in neighbouring North Korea as well. He'd seen it in Vietnam under Ho Chi Minh, and he'd seen it in Eastern Europe under people like Ceausescu and Tito. So he worked very hard to dismantle the cult of leadership, and that's one of the reasons why China was able to have relatively peaceful transitions from one ruler to the next, even to the extent of the succession planning to enable a handover to Jiang Zemin in 1992. From the point of view of national stability, Deng's got to take some credit for that. Looking at his legacy, China's place on the world stage owes a lot to Deng. Within a decade of his death, China was hosting the Olympic Games. That would have been unheard of had Mao still been the supreme leader. Trade, manufacturing, overseas investment, very much opening up the economy. And in terms of national prestige, the return of Hong Kong and also the province of Macau to Chinese rule helped underscore his ability to reunite China, with the eventual aim that they would bring Taiwan back into Chinese rule.
And this was very popular for the Chinese people, because the domination of China by foreign, mostly European powers, is an absolute sore point in the collective psyche of the Chinese. So to have this leader bring back Hong Kong and Macau is hugely symbolic. It's very significant, and it restores that national pride that allows governments to stay in power.
Yes, yeah, very much so. I'd like to share some quotes about Deng. In 1997, the New York Times wrote, and I quote, "A wily pragmatist, Mr. Deng led China to economic growth few Chinese had dreamed of," but also went on to say that he was an unyielding authoritarian. The Japan Times in 2014 devoted an article to his 110th birthday, called him pragmatic, a nationalist, but also made reference to the economic reforms that enabling China to become a global force. And then in 2018, the Washington Post referred to words that Deng used a lot, which were reform and opening, but they quite deliberately compared those to the glasnost and perestroika that Gorbachev tried to implement. The difference was that Gorbachev tried to do it from top down, whereas Deng reformed and opened up the economy at the level of production, the farms and the factories. The Washington Post also made reference to the World Bank's acknowledgement of the massive reduction in poverty that happened under Deng's rule, bringing the Chinese peasantry out of poverty and helping to raise their standard of living, because they actually had an incentive to try and produce more goods and get an economic return on those goods. But the means by which he did that, I've only given a couple of examples. So he wasn't afraid to be authoritarian.
Uncle Ian, perhaps this is a discussion that is too big and requires a separate episode, but if you have an authoritarian capitalist regime, is that just fascism?
I think we're going to meet more examples that'll prove that. And yes, you're right. It's not always as neat as a left-right divide. Sometimes the methods are very similar, and sometimes the nationalist outcomes are very similar as well.
Yeah, the nationalism is another component that makes it very fascist-like.
Yes. It's not like a seesaw where you're on one end or the other, especially if they're pragmatists like Deng, where they'll hitch a ride with whichever party looks like it'll get them to the top and then implement their policies from there.
I find his legacy will endure because of the strength of China. We have to compare him to Genghis Khan, one of the most famous leaders and conquerors in world history. But if you look at Deng Xiaoping, China becomes a world power because of his rule. The Chinese Communist Party is able to stay in power in China because of his repression. China becomes a manufacturing powerhouse. They reorganize the entire world supply chain around them. Deng Xiaoping is the reason that everything we own says made in China at the bottom.
Yes.
Like, that is hugely significant. If you think about the impact that has, not just within China, but outside of China, the impact on Australia and in terms of our proximity to China and our raw materials, and the discontent the outsourcing of manufacturing to China would create around the world, Deng Xiaoping is responsible for the election of Donald Trump. Because without the discontent in the manufacturing towns in what's called the Rust Belt in America, Donald Trump is not elected.
Mm.
And this Chinese Communist Party and the growth that they've achieved, this may go on for hundreds of years.
Yeah, and as you say, indirectly influence society and politics in other countries. That's a huge impact that China has had, and the opening up under Deng is pretty much where that started. Arguably, it's too early to measure his impact. The beautiful irony in all of that is that 800 years after he died, we're still talking about Genghis Khan. Will they still be talking about Deng in 770 years?
I don't think so, but that might be due to our own ignorance and our own biases more so than anything else. Genghis is famous because of the valor and excitement of conquest. But if you look at a picture of Deng Xiaoping, it looks like an accountant.
He doesn't stand out in a crowd.
He does not stand out in a crowd. He's not wearing any medals. He's not dining on the crushed bodies of his victims. In spite of that, he managed to be effective.
If we look at what criteria we want to use to compare them, as authoritarian as Deng was, in the category of biggest, baddest, meanest, I don't think there's a contest.
Yeah, so Genghis Khan wins the category of biggest, baddest, meanest. For those new to the podcast, we have a few criteria that we use. Biggest, baddest, meanest is definitely one of them, which Genghis Khan wins. And we also have the most significant. Who has been most significant?
The third category was looking at it from the perspective of the citizenry. So identifying if the average citizen was better off or worse off as a result of the rule of this particular dictator.
I think in terms of historical significance, we have to go with Genghis Khan. I mean, he gave us pants, he gave us tea, he didn't give us the chicken sandwich, but Genghis Khan is one man who really did change the world. He has the world's largest continuous empire in history.
But in terms of the citizenry, the impact Deng had on the Chinese population in terms of bringing them out of poverty has been massive. Comparing that to Genghis Khan, yes, it was a massive empire, but it only lasted a couple of generations. It had been built by his force of personality and to a large extent his brutality, but wasn't sustainable because it got too big for itself. China hasn't got to that stage yet, whether it does in the future. A little bit too early to tell. And I must admit, I came into this podcast thinking that Genghis Khan was going to be the winner by a long way.
I thought this too. I thought this poor Deng Xiaoping bloke is going to get absolutely demolished by Genghis Khan.
That was my initial thought.
I'm going Genghis Khan, but it's a lot closer than people would expect. You're leaning the other way.
It's tight. It's a lot closer than I expected. And a lot closer than any of our results thus far comes down to which of them is the more significant dictator. As things currently stand, it's really tight, Scott.
Oh.
But if I look 770 years into the future, do I think people will still be talking about Deng Xiaoping? My answer is no. Whereas here we are, we're still talking about Genghis Khan. Purely on that basis, I would have him as my winner, but only just.
This is a photo finish, and Genghis Khan just gets his nose in front of Deng Xiaoping. So sorry, Deng, you've been eliminated, and Genghis Khan remains in the contest to be crowned history's biggest dictator. Congratulations. That concludes this episode of Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. Next week, we are headed to the Middle East, where we have a matchup between Xerxes and Saddam Hussein. Thank you, Uncle Ian.
Thank you.